Well, welcome to another session on the class of Ecclesiastes, Searching for the Meaning of Life. The last session, we finished off chapter 10. Chapter 10 was all about foolishness and its effects. And we looked at least four different categories in which we can describe foolishness. Foolishness is something that's detectable. You can tell a fool. Foolishness is something that's dangerous. It causes harm. Foolishness is something that's delusional, meaning it's a twisted view of reality, and foolishness is devouring, in that it consumes and causes loss. We're going to start in chapter 11 tonight. So if you have your Bibles, you can turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 11. And in chapter 11, Solomon, the presumed author, is going to be launching into a description of life, but dealing with uncertainty. So let's start in the beginning of chapter 11, verse 1, it says, "Cast your bread on the waters, for you may find it after many days." This is a proverbial saying, cast your bread on the waters. That's the action that's encouraging. And then the result, it says, "For you may find it after many days." Well, I'm not sure about you, but soggy bread is not very appetizing to me. If I throw some bread on the water for some ducks or something, I don't want it back. There's clearly here a metaphorical meaning to this proverb. As in most proverbs, the imagery is meant to evoke an idea in the mind of the reader. And probably the most likely metaphor for this imagery is that of maritime trade. It seems that this would be alluding to the idea of bread being some type of commerce or trade that you would send out on ships to be sold at other ports, and that you would then retrieve or you would receive back the revenue from the sales when the ships would return. And this can also connect with verse 2, which says, "Give a portion to 7 or even to 8. This is a numerical proverb where it's saying that you do 7 or 8, that the last number is the one that is emphasized in the list. And this probably refers to boats or ships. And the reason to do this, it says, is for you do not know what evil may happen on the earth. So if the metaphor really does refer to maritime trade and commerce and things like that, and then having your shipment spread among multiple vessels, the wisdom for that is that you don't know what evil may happen, meaning if you have all of your supply, all of your shipment on one ship, and that ship happens to go down in the ocean, you lose everything. So it seems the wisdom here is about diversification in order for protection and security, given the unknown future, the uncertainty of what may happen. And this is something that I think we can resonate with. We do this a lot in various aspects of our lives. Take, for example, if you do any type of financial investing, it's not a good investment if you put your entire nest egg into one particular stock or company. What happens if that company goes bankrupt? Or what happens if the stocks for that particular company just plummet? You lose everything. In financial investing, a diversification of a portfolio is something that's often encouraged, where you have stocks and shares in different industries because of all the fluctuations that happen in the world. Having a large range of companies, which is kind of the idea behind a mutual fund, allows for fluctuations that balance each other out. Some industries might have a stock that goes up, while others might have a stock that goes down, and they can counterbalance each other so that you're not depending upon the outcomes of one particular sector of the market. This can probably be illustrated recently in times with the pandemic of COVID-19, where there were some specific sectors of industry that got hit really hard as a result of the pandemic. For example, transportation industry suffered greatly during the pandemic. Airlines, buses, and train companies, all their stocks and value went way down. They plummeted because people were not using them. On the other hand, there are other sectors of the industry, such as tech companies, outdoor outfitting companies, fitness equipment companies, delivery companies. these all had stocks that just skyrocketed. These were things that people needed during that time. And nobody foresaw this coming until it was here. And that's the wisdom here of verse 1 and 2 is about you don't know what the future holds. So it's wise to not bank on only one particular outcome. In verse 3, there's another proverb that emphasizes this aspect of uncertainty. It says, if the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth. And if a tree falls toward the south or toward the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it will be. Well, that kind of seems a little self-explanatory that if clouds are full of rain, then it's going to rain. And if a tree falls, then wherever it falls, it falls. What's this proverb trying to get at? Well, it's trying to get at the idea of you don't know exactly where. You don't know where the clouds are going to rain. It could rain here, could rain there. Just like when a tree falls. Before the tree falls, you can't predict if it's going to fall this way or that way. Now, if you're a lumberjack, you can cut the trunk in a way that has a high degree of probability of going a certain direction. But this is talking about just the randomness of nature. When a tree falls, it'll just fall, and where it falls is where it falls. And you don't know that ahead of time. There's an expression we use in our modern world that I think encapsulates this idea, and it's when we say, that's the way the cookie crumbles. It's just, you don't know that that's how the cookie's going to crumble, it just does. And how it crumbled is what you have now. Meteorology and weather patterns, in the ancient world, they seem to be quite random. People couldn't predict weather very accurately. Since the invention of things like satellites and other weather-collecting data probes, we're able to predict weather much more accurately now. However, it's still not 100%. Meteorology is basically a best guess practice based on a collection of data and certain analyses and models. And given our modern technology right now, if you look at a three-day forecast, it's typically about 90% accurate, they say. If you extend that out two more days to 5 days, it goes down to about 75%. 7 days is about 60% accurate. And you go to a 10-day and it is 50% or less usually accurate. I mean, it was supposed to rain 3 days last week here in the capital region of New York, and we got nothing, not a drop. So you can't always trust in the weather predictions, even though by and large, now in modern day, we can trust them more so than in the past. In verse 4, it reads, he who watches the wind will not sow, and he who looks at the clouds will not reap. An agricultural illustration here, sowing and reaping. This is dealing with a farmer and the activities of growing crops. And this is about the way that a farmer, the inevitable randomness of weather, that if you try to always predict the outcome of the weather, you will always be second-guessing it and then never actually acting. For example, here, if a farmer tries to predict when the wind will be favorable in order for them to sow, the more they look at the wind, they don't know what's going to happen the next moment after that, or 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later. And if they're trying to get certainty about how the wind is going to behave, they never will actually begin sowing the seed. And in the same way, if the farmer is looking at the clouds, if the farmer's trying to predict when there's going to be a dry season for a time in order to harvest, to reap the crop, they'll be looking at the clouds and then second-guessing themselves all the time. They will be paralyzed because they can't know whether the clouds will change and then rain before they even finish reaping the harvest. So what verse 4 is trying to get at here is that we can be paralyzed by the uncertainty of the future. And as one scholar summarized verse 4, they said, one cannot use the possibility of misfortune as an excuse for inactivity. Someone who is forever afraid of storms will never get around to working his field. And the teacher, which is the sage here, in effect says what this verse 4 is trying to say, that we're supposed to just face the fact that things may go wrong, but we're to get out there and do our work anyway. Sometimes when we're waiting for the perfect right conditions for something, we seem to always hesitate. There's a lot of instances in life, I'm sure, where we're just waiting for that moment so that we can then act. I come from the Midwest, and when we are merging onto highways where I come from, we get ready to merge, and then we wait for the opening, and the person backs up and gives space for us so that we can then join the lane. Well, I learned really quickly when I moved to New York that if I wait around for that space to open, it won't. It won't open if I'm just waiting for that perfect space that gives me a car length ahead and a car length behind. That's not the way it works around here, I found out. That you have to start actually taking the action and becoming part of the lane. And then as you're doing that, the space somehow opens up so you can get in. It's very unnatural to me, but I've grown accustomed to doing it now. But that's like the verse 4 here is saying, is that if you're just always looking to understand the future so that you can act appropriately all the time, you're not going to. We can't know the future. We have to act in the face of uncertainty. And furthermore, this is what is reinforced in verse 5 too. Just as you do not know the way the Spirit comes to the bones in a womb with child, even so you do not know the work of God who makes everything. So it goes from an agricultural metaphor now to a pregnancy. And the idea that there's so many things about the inner workings of how life begins and so many things about the work of God that are unknowable. Here, the idea of the way the Spirit comes to the bones in the womb with child, that we don't understand how life actually happens. That's beyond human understanding. It's one of the great mysteries of human existence is how a new life comes to be and the way that the fetus forms within the womb. We have no idea how the Spirit or the life enters the bones of that baby. These are great mysteries to humankind. In likewise fashion, trying to understand all the work of God, it's beyond comprehension. It's not something we can figure out. We understand the way that God works in some ways, but to understand the inner workings, that is unknowable. And so just like we can't really predict accurately the weather, we can't grasp all the intricacies of how life starts and begins, and likewise, we can't understand the way that God is working and how he has made everything proper in its time. That timing is not something that we can comprehend and grasp and then use to our benefit. The example of human ignorance in this regard is being used to make the point that even though we don't understand how things may really work, that shouldn't deter us and paralyze us into not doing anything. So while trying to figure out what's going to come in the future is not a profitable endeavor, we still need to act wisely in life and take reasonable chances, because that's what going into the unknown is that there's a risk. There's a chance that something might turn out in a way we had no idea beforehand. People who are skeptical or fearful, they will not move forward in life to even an opportunity when it presents itself. And so we do not want to be like those who don't act because they're afraid of what the outcomes might be. We have to act in spite of that uncertainty. I think acting in spite of this uncertainty is something that James writes about in his letter in the New Testament. I'd like to just read a passage real quick from the book of James. In James chapter 4, verse 13, it says, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go into such and such a city and spend a year there and do business and make a profit. You do not know what tomorrow will bring. What is your life? For you are a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you should say, if the Lord wants, we will live and do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogant plans. All such boasting is evil." Why is boasting about what you're going to do evil? Well, in this context, it presumes that you actually know the future and you know that your plans will succeed. Thinking that you have control over the vast complexities of the world and of life, that is arrogant. And James is saying that if you think you can go and do something and have confidence in that, saying that you're forgetting that it's not you who's deciding how everything is going to turn out. It's if the Lord wills for you to do this or that, then you should, not because you know what's going to be happening and that you have control over it. That is evil. And likewise in Ecclesiastes, facing the uncertainty of the future, thinking that there can be a prediction about it, that's the evil that James is talking about. And the wisdom of the Ecclesiastes, the Proverbs we're reading, is trying to point to that it's foolish to think that one can know all of these things about the future. And it's being paired with the complexities of life, the inner workings of life, and the work of God in the world. So let's jump back to Ecclesiastes, and we'll continue. We'll read verse 6. In 11:6, it says, "In the morning, sow your seed, and in the evening, do not withhold your hand, for you do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, whether they both alike will be good." So in the recommendation of Solomon here on the heels of the proverbial wisdom, the recommendation is, well, in the morning, sow your seed, and in the evening, do not withhold your hand. What this is talking about is going back to the agricultural metaphor about, well, work hard. Work hard regardless of the uncertainty of the future. You need to sow your seed in the ground so your crops will grow. Well, in the morning, get your butt out to the field and do your job as a farmer, sow the seed. And then in the evening, don't sit back and be lazy. Finish the work you need to do. So you don't. The explanation here is that you shouldn't not work hard just because the future is unknowable. You do not know what's going to succeed. So do both. Sow the seed in the morning, work in the evening. If you don't know the future, the best thing to do is try to prepare for all possibilities and all outcomes that could arise. So you don't know if doing one activity will actually yield the benefit you think, or doing another one will. Or maybe he says they both will. Who knows? There's a famous saying by a retired NHL hockey player, Hall of Famer, Wayne Gretzky. And he's famous for saying this line, "You miss 100% of the shots you don't take." That is, I think, the chewy kernel center of what this is about, is that if you actually don't do anything, you can never receive the benefit and the success that comes from applying yourself. So if you don't go out in the morning and sow your seed, or if you don't work hard in the evening, then you're not going to get anything. But if you do both, then one might succeed or the other, or both of them together might succeed. But if you're frozen by inactivity, if the anxiety of not knowing the future causes paralysis for you, then you are certainly going to fail, because doing nothing leads to getting nothing. Verse 7, it starts a new section. So it's moving now into, we're going to talk about life. And there's going to be two main themes to this section. And we'll see them in verse 8 here. But let's read verse 7. "Truly the light is sweet, and it is good for the eyes to see the sun. Indeed, if a man lives many years, let him rejoice in them all. But let him remember the days of darkness, for they will be many. All that comes is pointless." The metaphor of light here is representing life, representing those whose senses can perceive light. When you're awake and you're conscious and you're alive and your eyes can see light, then that's life. You're alive. And that is sweet. Sweet referring to that this is you taste it. The metaphor for tasting of something is to experience it. And in that experience, it's a delightful experience. It's a pleasurable experience. The verse is trying to say that being alive is good. It is something that's sweet. And it's good for the eyes to see the sun. This is just reinforcing the same idea of having your eyes be able to perceive the sun, that you're alive and it's good for you to be able to be on the earth and to be under the sun and living life. And then verse 8 follows up that indeed, if you're alive and if you live a long life, then you need to have these two things in mind. You need to be rejoicing and you need to be remembering. Well, you're to be rejoicing in all the years of your life, no matter how old you are, how young you are, rejoice in life. But as you rejoice in life, Solomon reminds the reader here that we need to remember that there are days of darkness. Darkness is a metaphor here for days of trouble, days of suffering, days of hardship, when life does not go right, when evil visits and causes and stirs up strife, oppression, injustice, and death. And that his idea that all these days that have darkness, there will be many. I think it's just a confession on his part that the brokenness of the world that we've read about, the way that the world is bent and it cannot be straightened, that there is this natural proclivity in the world for things to go wrong. And therefore, life will be filled with many days of darkness. But even in the midst of those days of darkness, we're still to rejoice through them. But everything that happens under the sun, as the author has said before, Solomon is saying it's all pointless. That all this activity under the sun, it really ultimately doesn't mean anything. It doesn't actually answer the question about what the true meaning of life is or what has ultimate purpose. How do you actually benefit and make profit from the activity under the sun? His conclusion has been from the beginning, it's pointless. There is none. So then in verse 9, we now get the actual instruction. He speaks directly to the reader, telling us, rejoice, O young man in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth, and walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. But know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment. So rejoice. He said we're supposed to rejoice all the years of our lives. And here he says, rejoice, O young man, in your youth. Now, it's not just to rejoice only while you're young. The idea here is that when you're young, this is a foundation of life that you're supposed to build. That young people should begin this process of rejoicing in life. And that it should then be formed in them to carry them throughout the rest of their life, all the years of their life, and for their heart to cheer them in the days of their youth. And this is that they're to walk in the ways of their heart and in the sight of their eyes. So if we walk in the ways of our heart and in the sight of our eyes, that sounds like kind of like hedonism, sort of, that we're going to kind of follow after whatever we like or whatever we desire, and that could get us into trouble. Well, Solomon's not saying that we're supposed to be pursuing the things of our heart, the ways of our heart and what we see with our eyes in some sort of reckless, immoral way, because he follows up here that as we do this, as we follow the ways of our heart and the sight of our eyes, we're to keep in mind that all these things that we do, God will bring us into judgment. So it's not an unrestricted sort of like have all this behavior that we desire without any consequence. It's that we are to pursue the desires in our life, the things of our heart and our eyes, which are organs of desire, things in our heart and our eyes. They form what we then crave and desire. And we're to do that in light of knowing we are under scrutiny by God and that we will be held accountable in judgment for the things we do. Therefore, when we pursue our desires in life, they are to be godly desires. They're to be desires that honor and submit to God, which we'll find out why that's important in the next chapter as the conclusion to the letter. But before we get there, we have a few more places to go. But I'm just going to conclude here in verse 10, at the end here of chapter 11, with the concluding statement of this section. So therefore, in light of this, that we're supposed to rejoice and that we're supposed to pursue the ways of our heart and what our eyes see, all under the auspice of being, we're going to be judged by God. Therefore, we should remove frustration from your heart and put away evil from your flesh, for youth and the dawn of life are pointless. Remove frustration. Previously, in Ecclesiastes, Solomon has talked about all the things in the world that are not understandable or that are pointless. He said that these things are frustrating to him. Frustration is the human condition, essentially. The ways that life doesn't seem to make sense. Things that should happen don't, and things that don't happen, that shouldn't happen, do. These things bring frustration. So Solomon is saying that you should just understand what the human condition is, that this is what life is. This is what life consists of. Therefore, remove the frustration from your heart and put away the evil desires from your flesh, because you know you will be brought into judgment. For youth and the dawn of life are pointless. Now, this refers to the idea that they're basically impermanent. You're not young forever. You're young for a time. And the dawn of life, when you're young, the beginning of life, and you're growing up, that then changes. And you become an adult. And then you grow old. And then you die. So the pointlessness is about the way that everything's changing. Remember, we talked about transitoriness in nature, and the cyclicalness that happens is all what makes it pointless. Everything seems to be constantly changing, and therefore nothing stays the same. And if nothing stays the same, nothing can be predicted, and nothing can be relied upon, because it's always in motion, and therefore it's pointless. He sees that with regard to life. Life is a continual motion from birth, ultimately then to death. And all of that just moves in one direction, never staying still, and therefore he doesn't see it having the value that other things do. So he calls it pointless. Well, we're going to take a short break now, then we're going to come back for the final chapter of Ecclesiastes to find out where has all of this been beating us.